everybody. Welcome to the Bonkers Brit. And this time, this episode... Bonkers! I've got another Brit. So it's got a double helping of Brit today. My guest today is Simon Brooks. Hi, Simon.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Now, Simon is a storyteller over on the East Coast. So whereabouts exactly are you?
So I'm in New London, New Hampshire, New England, New World. So I can't move. I have to stay here.
Darling, everything's new, isn't it?
It's all new. It's all totally new, although I've been here a long time. So yeah, it's I really like it here because it reminds me of the English countryside a lot. You know, the rolling hills and the trees and all that kind of stuff.
Lots of rain.
Yes. Well, we've got... It's 60 degrees out and drizzle right now, so it's like an English summer.
But I'm actually jealous, because here it's about, I don't know, 75, whatever. I just know. I mean, still shorts and T-shirts and flip-flops, and yet there's no rain, no rain at all. And I really can't believe how much I miss the rain.
Well, you've got to go down to Portland or Washington, and then you'll be all right, right?
Yeah. In the COVID,
Washington State.
COVID pandemic's not quite up for it.
No, it's not. Talk about stir crazy. I think we're all getting a slight tinsy-wincy taste of what it's like to be a prisoner.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Well, although actually, you know, it's quite luxurious being at home. Not being in a little cell. So I'm sure a prisoner wouldn't necessarily agree.
No, I don't think they would. I think they would say it's very different because we don't have screws, do we?
No. Well, it depends what types you're talking about, obviously. But yes.
Well, I guess. Okay, unless you're Noel Coward. in the Italian job.
Oh yes, yeah. God, I love that film. Okay, so let's just give you a bit of an introduction so that people know who you are, and then we'll go back to being silly. So you are you're British, obviously. You're a storyteller, a humorist, and a raconteur, darling, a raconteur. And you've been telling stories since 1991, but you've been doing it full time professionally since 2003, which I'm so impressed, because before the pandemic, well, also during the pandemic, that's how you made your living, wasn't it?
Yes, if you can call it a living.
I know. Silly poof, just sitting around telling stories. I mean, God,
it's
just a
right?
job for the boys, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's like you tell people what you do and they're like, so what do you do for a living? And it's like, that's what I do. And it's like, you make the money. People pay you to do that. And it's kind of like, yeah, well, they do, yeah. But it's you know, I mean, you don't do this job for the money, for sure. I mean, it's a job.
Tell me about it, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's a job that you do for love, and you get paid for it. But it's not, you know, there are some storytellers that have nailed it and they're making good money doing it. I'm at that point where I'm just about to make that leap, I think, but the pandemic kind of put the brakes on that.
Yeah, God, it's awful, isn't it? I know, it's the same. But since, for me, I've loved it because I've started up this online storytelling show, you know, 6 Feet Apart Productions, and I've got through that to meet all these wonderful people, including you, which have now come on my podcast. It's lovely.
Yeah.
but what I did learn was how little I'd actually knew about storytelling and how the difference between, you know, any old joke, getting up a moth or something and telling a story. I mean, there's a certain art to it, definitely. But it's anybody can do that with no training whatsoever, stand up, tell a story. And then you've got people who have been professional storytellers like yourself and, you know, Bill Lepp and Diane Fallat and Sheena Arnold, all those sort of people who you think, God, they're just like a whole different level. It's like going, say, I'm going out for a jog as opposed to an Olympic athlete. And that's what I think of the difference. It's like, I'm just going out for a very slow, struggly, not even a jog. And then you guys are up there fully training for the Olympics.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't liken myself to an Olympic athlete, that's for sure.
Would you not?
But, well, no. I mean, no. I'm like, walking up the road's good enough for me. I mean, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, yes. I really do. I understand that. But there's also this... The nuances that there are in the art form of storytelling. I mean, you know, you're talking about personal narrative, right? When you're talking about yourself.
Yes.
But there are some personal narrative storytellers out there. People like Reggie Carpenter, right?
Oh, yeah. She's amazing.
Who are absolutely phenomenal. And then you've got people like Jen Munro, another British person, right? Who is also a phenomenal. I mean, she tells stories that are very family oriented. Reggie tells stories that are deeply personal and incredibly healing. They they too are, you know, Olympic athletes. You know, they
I wasn't putting down personal storytelling. I'm just saying.
Oh, good.
But you can, I mean, I do personal storytelling. I just noticed that, you know, there's a lot of really, really excellent storytelling of all genres. I wasn't putting them down. I'm just saying that you can just get up as a moth type, like I did. I just went to the never been before, stood up, told a story. You couldn't do that when you're telling some of the traditional tales and how you go about it, because it's a real craft, isn't it? There's an art to how you take a story, like a fable, and make it your own and then tell it in a way that's compelling and enthralling. And that's what...
Right.
And I just feel blown over. And also, there's a lot of people who are telling personal stories, but they do it in such an elevated way. Like you're saying, Reggie Carpenter, or there's Kim Whitecamp, or... I mean, Bill Lett does that too. You know, well, they never quite know whether that's true or not with Bill Lett.
It's true. I think there's an awful lot of grey area there.
Yes,
there's very little black and white. It's all, you know, he's totally in the grayscale, right in the middle.
Oh, no, he's bonkers. I love him.
He's brilliant. He's a total genius.
Total. I'm a huge fan. So there are obviously lots of, you know, and you can get better and better, but I just didn't realise how many levels are, until I started doing the show and finding, and because of the pandemic, everyone's online now and you get to see these people like yourself. I would never have met you otherwise, you know, because we're all online now.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, this is one of the silver linings of, you know, everybody's been saying this about the pandemic. In our world, they've been saying this, is that I would see certain storytellers at certain events sometimes if I was lucky, right? If I was going to a national, you know, like the National Festival in Jonesboro or Timpanogos or wherever. Right, Athens is coming up this weekend, so you know I would have been working with Bobby Norfolk in the children's entertainment side of things with the schools and everything, but I'm not going to be doing that. And so these online performances allows anybody anywhere in the world to see these storytellers from anywhere in the world. So I'm seeing storytellers from Ireland that I've never heard of before. There are people in India that I'm hearing stories from, and it's been absolutely marvellous, because I can't afford to fly over to India.
No.
And like, oh, I'm going to go and see such and such a person in India.
You know? Yeah.
It's like a few thousand dollars and 3 months later. You know?
Case of a virus in the stomach or something.
Right. So it's, you know, that's been marvellous. But there's something about the art and craft of storytelling that requires a physical audience in front of you.
Mm.
You know, there's this energy that you feed off. You know, I'm always talking with storytellers. So, you know, I'm talking with somebody the other day and we're talking about, actually it was Megan Wells, and she came from a theatre background. And she said, when you're performing a theatre, the audience is watching, right? They're not really involved per se. They're watching something that's happening on a stage.
Yeah.
And they become emotionally drawn into the story. But that there's this connection with traditional storytelling and also with personal narrative where there's no fourth wall, you know, or you break through the fourth wall all the time because you're talking to the audience. You know, you're working with the audience on that story.
Mm.
And with, you know, and I'm not a teller of the personal narrative because, I don't want to scare people with my own stories. And I much prefer telling folk and fairy tales. But... With the folk and fairy tales, there's this magic that happens in the room, you know, and you can see people leaning forward. You know, you walk into a high school and all the kids are sitting there, they're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be awful. This is going to be like Little Red Riding Hood and Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Like, why are we, you know, 16, 17-year-olds going to sit through this? And then you throw a story at them like Beth Gellert, which is, you know, the Faithful Hound. Prince Llewellyn is given this puppy, this wolf hound puppy as a child. They grow up together. They do everything together. He follows him around. He gets married. He's at the wedding by his side, and the baby's born, and they go hunting out in the middle of Wales, and he comes back to the lodge and where the baby was, and everything's turned over. Tapestries are pulled off the wall. There's blood all over Gellert's muzzle. And the prince thinks that the hound has killed his son out of jealousy. And so he draws his sword and kills the dog. And as he kills the dog, as the dog wails, a child's cry is heard. And when they go to where that cry was coming from. They pull the tapestries away and the baby's there. And then they find a dead wolf that Gellert the dog had killed protecting the child, which is where the blood came from.
Aww.
So you tell high schoolers this story and they're all like, what the whack just happened? You know, so there are these incredibly deep stories that have so much meaning in them. You know, and even, you know, if I was talking with a bunch of high schoolers the other day, and or the other, not the other day, because I haven't been in front of high schoolers yet this year, but a couple of years ago, I was talking to these high schoolers and we were talking about Little Red Riding Hood. And, you know, you read that story as a six-year-old and it has one particular, you know, you'll see it in a certain way. And then you'll read that book as a 16-year-old and you'll read a completely different, you'll hear or see a completely different story. Then you read it as a 50-year-old and you see another story altogether. Because there are so many levels in that story. You know, it's not just about a precautionary tale about the girl keeping to the path. It's it's a lot more. There's a lot more to it than that. And, you know, it's like, when you read a book, when you read one of the myths, you know, like you read Beowulf or Gilgamesh at high school, you just kind of, it's just an epic, done with it, right? But then you read it later when you're 30 and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, Gilgamesh is this story about this crazy man who finds redemption because he's lost the greatest love of his life, which is Enkidu. You know, this guy that was sent down to balance him out because he was doing such terrible things, and Enkidu was sent there to save his people. When you read the stories later in life, I think Reggie said this the first time, she says, we grow into stories. You know, we might read a story and we can't, you know, like me with Beowulf, right? I love the story Beowulf. And I've tried and tried and tried and tried to tell it, but I can't. It won't let me, right? It's like, no, you can't tell this story. And I know it. I mean, I could, if someone said, tell Beowulf, I could get up on a stage and tell the story, right? I could do that. But I can't tell the story with authenticity, right? And I think that there are some stories like that. And we eventually get to a certain point in our life when we've had some experiences that we haven't had earlier that allow us to see what that story really means, and then we can tell that story.
Oh, how interesting. I didn't.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, because I don't tell those sort of stories, so that hadn't.
Right.
I don't think I'm deep enough. I'm a little bit.
Well, I didn't think I was. I didn't think I was until, you know, I started realizing that, you know, why can't I tell this story? You know, why isn't this coming out for me? Why isn't this working for me? Whereas I can tell this story and it comes out just like this. And it might be, you know, it might be an Irish tale that's equally deep, but it's a story that my life experiences have wrapped around or can wrap around that story. Whereas I'm not a warrior, you know, I'm a bit of a pacifist. So maybe that's why I can't tell Beowulf. Because it doesn't sit with me. And maybe the, you know, I can identify with Enkidu as the one who is the pacifist, if you will. He'll go out and fight for his friend and he'll do anything for his friend. But he doesn't like trouble. But if trouble comes to him, he'll sort it out, kind of thing. You know,
right.
He does what's right. And maybe that's why I can tell Gilgamesh, which when I first read that years ago, I was like, well, that's a stupid story.
I don't know that. I have to go and read that.
It's a Sumerian tale. Oh, it's amazing. It really is good. I've recorded it. I'll send you a download card.
Oh, yeah. No, lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you don't have to read it.
Even better. My failing eyesight now. Let's just carry on a little bit with some more of what you've done, because you've done achieved so much. You've obviously performed at all the major places like the National Storytelling Festival and Timpanagos. And you're going to Athens, which actually isn't in Athens. It's in Alabama, isn't it?
It is. It's, yeah.
Isn't it funny Athens, how in America that they keep having different names, like, you know, New London and New England and Athens. And it's,
I can travel around the world without, you know, traveling more than 300 miles. Right. Yeah.
So odd. So odd. And you've also got a mission. I'm going to read your mission off your website: to spread and share the art of traditional storytelling to a wider audience, to show the power and need of the ancient stories of folk and fairy tales, myths and legends, to encourage others to tell their own stories and favourite folk tales, and to keep the art of storytelling alive in all communities for young people and adults by performing live, conducting workshops, producing a podcast of traditional storytelling. Now, for those people who don't know, traditional storytelling is things like, you know, myths and folklore and old legends and things that have come down, like Hans Christian Andersen and all those, I can't say that name, and so on, as opposed to personal stories, which is more what I tell. I just tell people my, you know, airing a dirty linen in public.
Yes.
So that's a different, you don't really tell personal and I don't tell traditional. So it's quite interesting.
It is, because I think certain things speak to people, right?
Mm.
You know, it's like the folk and fairy tales don't speak to you, and maybe they will one day. I don't know, you know.
Oh, no, they do. I love them. I think they're great. I just haven't really delved into that so much.
Right. And then there's people like Reggie Carpenter, who does tell folk and fairy stories, but a lot of her work is now personal narrative. And I think the fact that people like her succeed so well is because she knows those folk tales and the fairy tales and the myths and the legends. She knows the motifs in those. She knows the hero's journey, if you will.
Mm.
Right. And so she can create a personal narrative story, a true story, something that happened to her, but incorporate these motifs and these.
Well, she really knows how to tell a story, doesn't she? She's learned how to, you know, from, you know, real, you know, the experts, if you like, the people that come before, who tell really amazing stories. And if you, presumably, if you tell enough of those and read enough of those, I mean, I'm a voracious reader, so from that point of view, but it's, then you can, you know, model that in your own storytelling, can't you?
You can, yes, yeah. I also think learning the myths and the folk and fairy tales, the ancient stories, the traditional storytelling, it really grounds you in how to create a really good story.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Tolkien and Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, those all of those books use traditional motifs taken from folk and fairy tales. You know, and he's, you know, the whole sequence in The Hobbit of Smaug the dragon, and that cup that is stolen and he wakes up, that's the story of Beowulf right there. That is the end section of Beowulf.
Mm.
And so, you know, that these early fantasy writers, they took a lot of the folk and fairy tales, the myths and the legends, the epics, and recrafted them. And that's what makes them so good, because that I think these stories are in our DNA. They speak to us on a micro level. It really does speak with, yeah, I mean, it's the, I don't know, the first or the second oldest profession, if you can call it that, you know.
Sitting around the campfire.
Sitting around the campfire, right? I mean, it's what we've always done. We've told stories, and it was one thing to explain the world around us when it first started, but like, you know, Hansel and Gretel, I always come back to Hansel and Gretel, because in the olden days when we didn't have the luxury life that we have today, right, the soft, easy life that we all have today. You know, if you were starving to death as a family, it wasn't uncommon that you would abandon the elderly or the children, right? Because the elderly, they've had their life, right? The children, they haven't had much of a life. It's easier to put them in the woods and have them be killed by wild animals or to drown or whatever, because that's a much faster death than starvation, a lot less painful. And so they looked at it as something that was merciful, and it wasn't a terrible thing to leave your kids in the woods. It was, you know, this is a much quicker way to die than dying of starvation, right? When you start hallucinating and you know, being torn apart by wild animals might be wicked scary.
Yeah, I don't think that's
terribly completely
nice,
terrifying. Well, I know, but, you know, think about it. You know, you can slowly starve to death.
But could they not slowly starve to death in the woods as well? If they didn't?
Well, they could.
Or get, you know.
They could, but they would probably be eaten. But the likelihood of them being, just, you know, an accident happening in the woods and them having a much faster death than starvation was much greater. I mean, it was, right?
Okay.
And so the kids are left in the woods and they find the salvation of the witch, right? Who, you know, there's always these predators in the woods. So they're teaching the kids about predators. And even now, right, kids are not abandoned in the woods, but they're abandoned by their parents.
Well, they are, aren't they?
Right? They are, right? I mean, in some ways, maybe more in the pandemic, because we're trying to focus on our work at home. but we can't do as much because the kids are around and distracting us. So we work later at night, so we're not spending as much time with the kids, you know, concentrated time, focused time, being in their presence and being present in their presence. You know, there were parents that traveled all around the world or all around the country and they were never at home. Their parents were divorced and they don't get to see their children. So the kids can, you know, they might see themselves as being abandoned. So they can identify with these kids, Hansel and Gretel, right? And then the predator in the woods, the witch, you know, there's predators all over the place in the world that we live in, right? You know, the big bad wolf, it's, that's another predator, right? And how do you, you know, how do you overcome that? There are helpers out there. There's the huntsman in Little Red Riding Hood who helps save the old woman, the grandmother, and Little Red Riding Hood. In Hansel and Gretel, it's the kids that save themselves because they were smart and they thought, they looked at the resources that they had and used them. And so these stories are subliminally teaching us all of this stuff, right? And I think that there's this huge problem now where people don't know these stories. And I think that's why there's no discourse, you know, because we don't know how to have discourse anymore. And a lot of these old stories, they talk about it. I mean, you read some of the sagas, the Icelandic sagas. They would talk for days over an issue, right? And that's how they would solve them. And nowadays, it's just like, no, la, 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 I'm right, la, 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 la. They cover up their ears and they just shout at you. And it's like, no, let's have some horrible, let's have it? Some conversation, some discourse. Let's have, you know, let's try and figure this out. And a lot of the folk and fairy tales and the myths and the legends, they talk about this, you know? And I think we need to bring back folk and fairy tales into the home and, into, you know, read them. I mean, obviously, there are stories that you don't want to read to your kids because, you know, like the children playing at Slaughter, one of Grimm's stories.
Yes.
You know, you don't want to be reading that to a six-year-old because they'll be in therapy for the rest of their lives. But, you read the stories and you think, all right, this I can tell this to my child and I can explain it to the child. If my kid is, like, getting anxious, then we can talk about it, right? And it's in a safe environment.
Mm. I absolutely love telling stories to my kids. I mean, that was my favourite time, even though it was a bit horrible because you're tired and they're tired. But bedtime stories were always the best and I just loved it. I used to always tell them stories.
Right. I mean, my son, when he was 16, he was still occasionally asking me to tell him stories or read to him.
Well, you're pretty sometimes good at telling stories, so that's probably why.
Some of the stuff he wanted me to read was stuff that he was supposed to read himself. So, you know. So I'd get the book out and I'd read it to him, but he was good at listening. He was tuned into listening.
It's quite an art form though to listen, isn't it? Because that's another thing that storytelling teaches you is how to listen properly. You know, active listening.
Oh yeah, yeah, it really does. Because you can't tell a story if you don't listen.
No.
Which I know sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not.
No, it isn't.
Because you have to watch the audience and you have to listen to the audience, even though they're quiet. You can still tell if an audience is starting to get restless, and you need to be aware of that so that you can either make changes in the way that you tell the story to keep them engaged.
Yeah, which you can't do, of course, online, can you? Which is the hard bit.
It's hard to do online. Yeah, I was doing a gig a couple of days ago, and the teachers are like shutting the cameras off. I'm like, no, let me see the kids. You know.
Yeah.
I've got a 13-inch monitor that I'm looking at. trying to gauge their reactions, and they got backlit, so they're just like these little shadows and silhouettes. But
are you doing quite a lot with kids then? Is that what you...
I would say it's 50-50, like kids and adults right now, for sure.
So when you're doing stuff with kids, what are you actually doing?
Telling them stories.
Is that what you get employed to do, just to tell a story about...
Well, I do workshops as well. A lot of the time I'm going in to tell stories and I'm sharing them with, you know, certain stories for certain grades. As the kids get older, the stories get deeper and longer.
Because we never had that when I was at school. We never had anybody coming in telling us stories.
Well, I seem to remember a storyteller coming into me into our school, in primary school, in elementary school. Yeah. Mm. But I just remember the one. It's just a vague memory.
I think that's amazing that you get to do that. Because, I mean, your storytelling's really fantastic. I mean, it's...
Thank you.
A story. You're going to tell a story later, so they'll be able to hear you. But you know, when you see you as well in your expressions and you do all the funny voices, I think
I do. Yeah. So it's kind of funny because you know sometimes you get the kids any questions or answers, and they're like, yeah. How'd you make all those noises? And it's like,
yes, your noises are really good.
You're a boy. You know how to make noises. You know, it's like, I mean, that's really all it is.
Well, my husband and I were listening to your story the other day, and you were doing all these funny noises about the clip-clopping of a horse and a puffing of somebody coming up the stairs because it was a giant. And it was brilliant, and it was so effective how you put the noises in as sound effects, and it was really good.
It's a lot. Yeah, I love it. There's this school where you can go to learn how to do sound effects using natural objects instead of synth stuff.
My son Tom's into all of that, and we went and had a look at that for him.
Yeah, I think that would be fascinating to do. Mm. I mean, you know, I don't think I'd make any money. Well, I'm not making any money now, but anyway.
Oh, how I know the feeling.
It's such an art. You know, I was thinking about this the other night, right? Is that what we do is real. We're using our own talents to create these stories. Photography, is something I used to do years ago. It's when I went to college and studied, right? And, you know, it was film, it was paper, you print on it, you'd use chemicals. There was all this manhandling of stuff to create a final image, right?
Yeah.
And film, you know, even when film was cheap, still had a budget to stay within. If you're going to go to a wedding and shoot a wedding, you'd have to what kind of package do you want? Do you want 100 pictures or 500, right?
Yeah.
Because you'd have to budget for it. And you would take these films and they'd be processed and you put them in a machine and they would be printed out. And you know, a lot of the stuff that I did was hand printing and hand processing, right? But now it's, you take it on a machine, you plug the machine into another machine, and then you print out the picture from another machine and there's no human interaction with it, right? And I think that there's a lot lost in that process. You know, and I think that storytelling, you know, there's none of that human contact. And I think storytelling, especially now, it allows us to reconnect with other people. And this is the one thing that I don't like about all of the online shows is that you can't connect with these people and you can't talk to the kids afterwards. And you don't get kids coming up and say, oh my gosh, that was so good. And it reminds me of blah, blah, blah. Mm. And then you say, yeah, we'll keep telling that story. You give the kids permission to tell that story and encourage them. And, you know, going back to the first question, like, what do I do in schools? It's like, you know, some of the workshops that I do, you know, I'll do a presentation, maybe, a full assembly presentation first off the bat. And then I'll go into classrooms and I'll do a little bit of workshopping with the younger kids. And then I'll do like a big workshop with the older kids and maybe come back a couple of times to work with the older kids and teach them the art of storytelling. And
fabulous.
The things that you teach the kids in storytelling, it totally translates into writing as well. Mm. And editing. And, you know, you talk about the characters in the stories and what kind of character would you want to be? You know, what are the traits that you would like to have? And then have them make a list of those traits. And then you say, all right, you keep that, put that somewhere safe, pin it up on your wall at home and see if you can become that person, right? Because everybody has that opportunity to become them, whoever they want to become.
Well, that's nice.
Even if they have a really shitty home life, you know, which it's not unusual. And you walk into a classroom and some of the teachers will be, oh, watch out for that kid over there, they're nothing but trouble. And it's like, oh, that's the kid I want to hang out with. because for the first time, when you teach them the craft of telling a story, it's the first time that they've had a positive experience as a group, where people are actually actively listening to this person telling a story. And that is so empowering. And it's not just like the kids shouting at the teacher or, you know, being sent to the principal's office because they're being a pain in the neck, but they're actually enjoying what this kid is doing and they're actually enjoying what the kid is saying and they're having empathy with this kid. And all of a sudden, that kid that was like a bit of a pain in the neck finds a different avenue where they can focus their energy. And they become, I would say, 9.5 times out of 10, this kid that was pointed out as being, oh, you're not going to hear anything from them, they're a bit of a wallflower, they're just too shy, or this is the kid that's always going to, you know, watch out for them, they're the troublemaker. Those are the kids that actually flourish with storytelling.
Wow.
And they come alive and they find something within themselves. It's freaking awesome.
How amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's just...
That must be really incredible. Nice to see that, mustn't it?
Oh my God, yeah, it really is. I mean, the first time I did a, a, a week, it was the equivalent of a week-long workshop. It was spread out over a month, and I go in every couple of days or so, right? And there was this one class, and there was this girl who was pretty quiet on the first day. And then the second day, she was totally into it. And at the end of the 5 weeks is what it turned out to be, is that this teacher came up to me and said, that girl who was, you know, the main part of your whole production thing here, she was a wallflower. She wouldn't speak up in class. And now she's having positive contributions.
Wow.
And it's just like, I had no idea. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, you just give them the opportunity to flourish, and you give them a safe space to bear witness to themselves with their colleagues, with their classmates. And then the classmates see that they're being vulnerable, and that they know that they have to be vulnerable as well when they're telling their stories, whether it's a folktale or whether it's personal narrative, right? And they just, oh, it's just brilliant. I just love it. I can't, you know.
That sounds really nice. Because you do a lot of work with the children. You do a lot of work with the Children's Literacy Foundation, don't you?
I do. Yeah, they give me a lot of work. That's amazing. So that was set up.
Talk about that a bit. So yeah.
Yeah. So the Children's Literacy Foundation, they were set up, I think probably it's coming up for 20 years now. The guy that started it, he was I think he was an investment banker.
Oh.
And he would come up here and vacation up in Vermont and New Hampshire, and he was reading a local newspaper up here, and he saw that the literacy level of children in New Hampshire and Vermont was spiraling downwards at a rapid rate. And he made the decision to, instead of making rich people richer, that he would actually help people in less well-off, more challenged communities. And so he started the Children's Literacy Foundation. He would raise money to buy brand new books and take them into these rural schools and rural libraries that couldn't, you know, that didn't have a budget for these kinds of things.
How nice.
And then he started bringing in the authors of some of these books to talk about their books. Because we got, you know, there's a plethora of New England storytellers, and not storytellers, but children's writers and illustrators.
Authors.
We got, right? And so you get those going in. And then I was working in a library as a feral children's librarian, completely untrained, but nobody else wanted the job. So I was like, I guess I'll take it. You know, I need a bit of extra money. So I became a children's librarian for 7 years. And we were looking after these books for this summer camp. And so I went to visit the summer camp, and it was this camp that was set up for kids of migratory families. So these are, you know, Vermonters and some New Hampshire people who, you know, eighth generation Vermonters who followed the crops throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of economical and educational challenges in these families, but there was also, you know, a certain amount of abuse, all sorts of different levels of abuse, sadly. And when I saw these kids, when I was, you know, giving these books out, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to come and do storytelling for this group. And so I volunteered to come down and spend half a day telling stories with these kids, and it was freaking awesome.
Nice.
You know, these kids who have no idea what storytelling is and what they're getting. And now I've got somebody like Odds Bodkin, who lives, you know, a couple of towns away, who's one of the best storytellers of myth and folklore in the States. You know, he volunteers his time and comes up every summer as well, and we tell stories together with another storyteller, Karen Pillsworth. And these kids have no idea that they're getting these. I mean, nobody knows what storytellers are, and, you know, it's like, oh, I'm really famous in the storytelling world, which means I'm not really famous at all, right? I'm about as famous as your local milkman, you know, your local firefighter.
And, it's such a shame. I think that's what I've just... We'll come back to that in a minute, because I've got some ideas.
Yeah. And so they got these, you know, they got myself, who's a pretty good storyteller, and they got Odds Bodkin, who's an internationally known, world-famous storyteller, coming in and telling them stories because he loves these kids. And they have no idea. You know, he's just a guy telling stories, but he tells really good stories, and he does it so well. And to see these kids come alive when you're telling these stories, it's brilliant.
So nice. So
brilliant. Anyway, Cliff, give these books away, and their program has grown now. So they went from just doing rural libraries and schools into communities, and now they've got a program which goes into the prison systems.
Mm.
And so I'll go into a prison and give out books to the parents, who will then mail the books to the kids, or they'll have these books that they read to the children over the phone, so that they can break that cycle of absenteeism and reconnect with their kids.
Oh, that's nice.
And help. Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, this kind of work helps bring families together. And if you've got a family, you know, if you're tight with your family, you don't really want to be a criminal.
No. Like we were saying, like, you know, stories are really connecting, aren't they? Whether they're personal or...
Oh, absolutely.
They just connect people immediately. And, you know, I love it. And like we used to always, when we had the kids at home, we always sit around and have our family evening meal around the table. We always did, and tried not to have bloody phones at the table. And we just chat. Sometimes it was really boring, nerdy chat that I would want to die. But other times, you could have some really interesting conversations if they weren't being too teenagery. But the fact that we all sat down and there was an opportunity to say what you've been doing in the daytime, any problems, anything to come up. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but it was a really lovely thing, and I'm really glad we did that. And we all, my husband and I both quite like cooking, and so we'd always cook from scratch, and we'd always do family meals. And it's just a really nice thing. And stories come from that, don't they? Because then you talk about what happened when you were younger, or this family story that, you know, and it just carries on, you know. And funny
stories
things that happen.
Stories.
Yeah, and that's part of like sitting around the campfire, isn't it? If you don't have the opportunity to do that, if you don't sit around a table or have a family get together, then you don't, you know, you don't have the opportunity for that, do you?
No, you don't. Yeah, you know, you'll listen to your kids, you know, bemoaning about something that happened at school. And it's like, well, back when I was, we would have these chalkboard erasers thrown at us, and they were made of wood, not this lightweight plastic rubbish that's on schools. These were solid oak, and they were. Crack your skull.
They did. And they used to throw them. I mean, even at our school, they used to throw stuff at them, at us.
Well, the physics teacher that we had at high school, you know, when we first came into his classroom, he said, you might be wondering why I've screwed two car wing mirrors to the chalkboard. This is your first lesson in physics. I can see reflection. I can see you in the wing mirrors when I'm writing on the board. So there will be no tomfoolery in this class.
Brilliant.
And we were just like, oh shit.
He's a clever son, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He scared the crap out of us when we first went in. He had the Malin streak. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
The grey streak across the side of his head. He had this Malin streak going on, and was one of the most formidably frightening teachers I ever had. But as we, you know, went on from being like these 11-year-old kids absolutely petrified of him, by the time we got to 16, he was the best freaking teacher we had.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the pranks he could play, oh, my God, it was amazing. So there was this one kid in our class whose name shall remain unnamed. And,
I think we should name him Bob.
Bob. Or Frank. Yeah, yeah. And
he is Bob.
No, he wasn't Bob. He wasn't Bob. He wasn't Robert. No, so he would fall asleep in class. And Tavender, Mr. Tavender, he was the teacher. He was just like, you know what? It's better if he sleeps because he's less trouble, right? And so one day he decided to play a prank, and this kid fell asleep at his desk, and he's like, shh, and he got all of us. We went into the closet, you know, the science closet with all the microscopes and whatnot. Well, not microscopes, it was Bunsen burners, because it's physics.
Yeah, Bunsen burners, I love Bunsen burners.
Yeah, me too. And he went into the classroom and he changed the time on the clock. He moved it forward. This was like the last period of the day, right?
Oh,
he moved
brilliant.
It forward 2 hours. And then he called up the deputy head, and then he called up the custodian. And so the custodian came down, this is what we all heard afterwards, but this is what happened. So the custodian came down, he started sweeping the halls. Everyone in that block put their, you know, put the shutters down on the glass, because a lot of these rooms had like the shutters for doing films and stuff, right? Because in those days we had film and the room had to be dark, so it had shutters on the windows and on the doors and the windows and the doors. And we're all watching through this tiny little slit, all like 25 of us, you know, like an eye here and a nose there. And Burp, this kid, wakes up, right? And he lifts his head and he looks around. And he's like, you know, he had quite a foul mouth. And I won't repeat what he said, but he was like, oh, golly gosh, where has everybody gone? And then he looked up at the clock and he's like, oh, golly gosh, is that the time? Right? And he ran out of the classroom. Well, the custodian was there, right, sweeping the floor.
Was he part of the prank then?
Yeah, it was all part of the prank. And he's like, what time is it? And he's like, oh, it's 6 o'clock. And he's like, oh, bother and like took off. But then the deputy head was coming down, right? So the deputy head is like, oi, Bob, where do you think you're going? He's like, it's 6 o'clock, sir. And he's like, not by my watch, it's not. Get back in that classroom now. And he's like having this discussion with the deputy head. And so the deputy head leads him back, probably by his ear, into the classroom. And we're all sitting back at our desk.
And he's like, nothing's happened.
Is it nothing's happened? And he's looking around going, what the whack has happened, you know? And then we all start bursting out in laughter. So he was like a freaking awesome teacher. But
oh,
you know,
how fabulous.
Yeah, 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 it was. But we were, you know, when we were all 11 years of age, 12 years of age, we were petrified of him.
Yeah.
But by the time we were like 15, 16, he was the best teacher ever.
Excellent. My friend in England is a physics teacher. And she's just brilliant. She has got the best sense of humour. And she's really funny. And she did an experiment, which I don't think everyone, the parents liked, but the kids loved it. And it was to demonstrate electricity or something. And she got them all touching each other. And then she electrocuted something, one of them. And they all passed on the electrical current around the whole group or something. I'm nice. Obviously getting it wrong. But and they absolutely loved it because they all got electrocuted a tiny little bit. But I don't think the parents were very happy. She loved it, though.
Well, I imagine by the time it got to the light, it had to be enough voltage to go through the first kid to get through to the last kid. Because each time the power starts to be absorbed into everyone's body.
So the first kid's really
the first kid. The first kid's hair was probably standing up on end. But the kid at the end, he's, you know, maybe their fillings were just tingling. Oh, yeah, I got one, yeah. Meanwhile, the other kid's like comatose on the floor.
So maybe that was it. Maybe the parents weren't there. They were really pleased.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Ah, school days. You've got to love them.
Yeah, I know. I know. Things have changed a lot, though. I mean, God, there's Brandon Spars, who I had on my podcast a couple of episodes ago. He's a teacher, and he teaches a lot of English and history and that. And he tells the most amazing stories, all involving folklore and different things. And it's so fascinating. And if he'd been my teacher, I would have absolutely loved history. Whereas my history teacher, and think of all the richness of what we've got, particularly in England, of history.
Yeah, right.
And it was the most boring class I've ever known in my entire life. In fact, Helen, who's this friend of mine who's a teacher, she actually highlighted exactly how bad it was. The teacher, who was our headmistress, in fact, and she was a very weird person, and she would just stand at the front of the class and dictate, and you had a rough notebook, and you had to write down really quickly what she said. And then your homework was to write it up in neat. And that was the lesson. And Helen said she had to go and buy a particular type of pen that was enabled her to write really fast because she couldn't keep up otherwise. And that was it. And that was our lesson.
Yeah.
I mean, my
math teacher at high school was a bit like, well, I went to secondary modern school. Mm-hmm. And then I, instead of going to like a community college or whatever, I went to a grammar school because my stepfather, my evil stepfather, told me. And so I did a year, I'd crammed 2 years of O-level, because I did my CSEs, right? And I went to the grammar school and crammed 2 years into 1 year of O-level. Mm. And my math teacher there was horrible. It was the same kind of thing. It's like he'd just talk and write stuff up on the board. And I had no idea what was going on.
That's not teaching, is it? That's just...
No, it's not. But we had two history teachers at Perd as well. And the first teacher, he was given a nervous breakdown by some of the rough kids. And the second history teacher that we came in was absolutely brilliant. He looked like Bill Oddie.
Oh, I remember
from
Bill Oddie.
From the Goodies, right?
The Goodies, yeah.
Yeah, and so we called him Bill. We just, you know, he was Bill. And he told us stories. And, you know, years later, when I ended up being taken to a storytelling event with this school group when I was running youth hostels in Hastings, Eric Madden was telling these stories, and I was like, I remember these stories from the stories that Bill told. You know, because he was telling historical stories at the battle, you know, in battle, just outside of Hastings, where the Battle of Hastings took place. And, you know, stories of Cromwell, and I was like, yeah, I remember these stories.
Because they are fascinating stories.
Yeah, they are.
How can you make history boring when... But honestly, that's why my history is absolutely appalling, because as soon as I could, I think when I was 14, I just gave it up. I'm not doing that anymore. That's nonsense. And I took other things for my O-levels. But I do remember in RE, which I wasn't interested in religion at all, but I do remember she used to tell stories about the Romans. She did myths. Perhaps it was Greek. I don't know.
Maybe a bit. Well, I mean, the Greek and Roman myths, they kind of merged anyway.
They did, and it came into RE. I think she taught both. Maybe that was it. And so she mixed the two classes up somehow. But I do remember her doing something about the Roman viaduct and a nappy going down or something.
Oh, really?
And it was something.
So she was teaching physics as well.
Yes. Probably. I can't remember what it was. I don't know. I think she got told off for it or something. I don't know. But it was. I still remember that she told a story about it. So, you know, it did go in, whereas everything else, no idea what it was. It was so interesting talking to Simon that I've had to split it into two parts. So this is the end of part one, and I'm going to upload part two next week. So look out for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and see you in the next episode. Bye.